There is the sense of watching the remake of an old and familiar movie. The actors have changed, but not the plot. One senses that one has watched the action unfold and one knows the inevitable conclusion. The headlines about Laos in 1970 are quite like headlines about Vietnam in 1960. There's the same surprise, or is it really surprise, when an American embassy turns out to be a forward command post for military and paramilitary operations, when a commercial, so-called commercial airline sent by our aid monies to bring farmers and supplies to far distant hamlets turns out to be the ferry which brings soldiers and military cargo to the mountains of Laos. There is the same sense that all this is a very complicated, extravagant masquerade, a secret kept from one is not quite sure whom. One is not quite sure what purpose. A secret war being fought for uncertain goals, the only certainty being that we are not achieving those goals. But despite all of the military aid to Laos, despite the guns and the trucks, despite the military instructors, despite millions and almost $1 billion worth of military aid, the forces of the Pathet Lao and of the North Vietnamese have moved further westward towards the Mekong Valley than ever before. And despite aerial bombardment and aerial mining and defoliation and hit-and-run ground activity, our forces have not been able to choke off in any significant way the flow of supplies from North Vietnam through the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos down to the south. It's estimated that Laos today is a country of something between 2 and 3 million people. Like Vietnam, it's becoming a country of refugees, where it's estimated that there are between 300 and 500,000 refugees already in that mountainous land. Defoliation, refugees, saturation, bombing, the CIA, the secret war, Souvanaphouma playing the role in Ngo Diem, our chosen feudal lord in that part of the world, our friend appealing to Washington for further aid. It's an old movie. There's a ghostly sense of déjà vu. We've seen it before. We keep asking ourselves, have we learned nothing? Have not we learned something from 35,000 American deaths, from $200 billion of wasted American treasure? And the answer, I'm afraid, is that we have learned surprisingly little, that we are doing things exactly as we did them a decade ago. The parallels are too close to be anything but preternatural. There was then, as there is now, this attempt to cloak what we are doing in a mantle of secrecy. Whom are we fooling? The Pathet Lao, the North Vietnamese, have their friends and their representatives in the Vietnam itself, Vientiane, the capital of Laos itself. They have an embassy there. They can count the trucks going down the 2 or 3 highways of Laos. They can count the number of planes that fly overhead. The enemy knows what's happening. All that these secret wars do is to keep the secret from the American people, to preclude the opportunity of Americans to come to grips through a national debate in the value of this commitment or that, particularly in this case, our commitments in Southeast Asia. The present administration has been in Washington for 15 months now. Until 12 days ago, no major report had been offered the American people about our involvement in Laos. And finally, the president at Key Biscayne made a significant statement, but he did so only under pressure. Under the pressure of a growing number of newspaper exposés and of senatorial comments, which in a sense forced him to state publicly what was happening, or his understanding, or his desire for us to understand what was happening in that part of the land. And of course, the American people were understandably suspicious of this report, which had been wrung from an unwilling president under suspicious circumstances. You and I, and I think most Americans, are deeply troubled by the growing polarization of the national debate. It seems that we cannot talk reasonably with one another. Everyone is taking one extreme position or the other. Why? I've always felt that the extremism which is abroad in our land is due less to the generation gap and more to the credibility gap. When a government treats its citizens as children and assumes that just as we do with our very young children, they cannot absorb certain facts, they will not accept certain ugly, difficult, sacrificial duties unless they are led to it, manipulated into it. When a citizenry is treated as if it is a child, it responds as children do, mulishly, angrily, bitterly, balking all the way. And if what we need in this country of ours, and this I firmly believe, is a defusing of the political debate, the growth of a great central moderate middle position where we can understand and reason out and work through and develop an intelligent foreign policy, then surely the government must begin to level with its citizens, to bring us into its secrets, so-called secrets, to let us understand at least what the enemy already knows, what we are doing, the extent of our military commitment, and presumably the purposes of it. But it required a Senator Cranston of California giving, in a sense, the lie direct to the Secretary of Defense, who 3 weeks ago had restated the position that there were no American combatant ground troops in Laos, who went on the public television and said simply, "This is not so. I have talked to the soldiers who have fought in Laos." And it took a Senator Stuart Symington, the chairman of a subcommittee, the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Senate on Southeast Asia, who refused to publish a report that had been submitted to his committee by the State Department after it had been censored and after it had been vulgarized because he said it was too bland. It did not give an accurate assessment of what was in fact happening. It required the public announcements in our press by three American reporters who walked through the jungles of Laos from Vientiane, some 16 miles, to a large American CIA base where they found there was a plane taking off and landing every minute, where they found an airstrip large enough to take the most powerful jet bombers that we now have, where they saw massive multi-million-dollar American military installations. It required this kind of pressure and this kind of release before our government began to tell us, as the president did from Cape Key Biscayne 12 days ago, these are the facts. Now, no one was particularly surprised by the facts when they appeared. We have long known that Laos was a divided country and that we were somehow involved politically and in paramilitary fashion in that country. But would it not have been far better if, upon assuming his office, several months later, the president, on his own initiative, had released these facts? If he had told the American people then, these are the reasons which in our judgment lead us to this involvement. Let's understand them, let's debate them, but this is the nature of our involvement now, and we will not make any further commitments until this issue has been placed before the Senate and debated in a democratic fashion. Instead of which, this not-so-secret war has run on, and the American people, only 15 months later, were able to wring this kind of admission from our government. President Nixon said on the 7th of March, "These are the facts. There are no American ground combat troops in Laos. We have no plans for introducing ground combat forces into Laos. The total number of Americans directly employed by the U.S. government in Laos is 616. In addition, there are 424 Americans employed on contract to the government or to government contractors. No American station in Laos has ever been killed in ground combat operations. U.S. personnel in Laos during the past year have not increased. When requested by the Royal Laotian government, we have continued to provide military assistance to regular and irregular Laotian forces in the form of equipment, training, and logistics. The levels of our assistance have risen in response to the growth of North Vietnamese combat activities. We have continued to conduct air operations. Our first priority for such operations is to interdict the continued flow of troops and supplies across Laotian territory on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. In addition to air operations on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, we have continued to carry out reconnaissance flights in North Laos and to fly combat support missions for Laotian forces when requested to do so by the Royal Laotian government. Now, there's nothing particularly surprising in this kind of revelation, quotation marks. I think Americans expected it. It was reassuring to many Americans, and I think it was meant to be reassuring. The emphasis was on the fact that there were no ground combat troops and that there was no plans for introducing such troops into Laos. But unfortunately, Americans have grown suspicious of governmental statements. We have been manipulated too often. The credibility gap has been around for too long. And unfortunately, again, there are certain discrepancies between these statements and reports which come out from Laos, from newspaper writers and columnists, and others who, observers who are there. It's hard to know who is right and who is wrong. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy of the first order. And many of us are tempted to suspect that governmental statements are, if not guilty of omission, are guilty of often putting the emphasis where it ought not properly to be put. President Nixon, in this Key Biscayne statement, in a sense said this: there has been a constant escalation by the North Vietnamese of the number of troops that they have in Laos. Particularly in the last 6 months, some 7,000 to 8,000 troops have been introduced into the country. We have done nothing but respond in kind. The initiative has never been ours. And we are not now engaged in ground combat operations, and we have no intentions of doing so. Unfortunately, he did not say that we will never do so or that we will not do so until the issue is submitted to the American Congress. But one reads in the paper that there are sources in Laos, presumably reliable sources, who say that they know nothing about an increase of North Vietnamese forces in Laos in the last 6 or 7 or 8 months. And there are reports which come out of Laos which say that, in fact, the American aerial bombardment has escalated dramatically in the last year or year and a half. That once we called off the aerial bombardment of North Vietnam, we shifted the targets for our Phantom fighter bombers of the 7th Fleet from North Vietnam to Laos, and that they've been pounding that country with routine sorties and missions. And we do know that in January of this year, for the first time, our B-52 bomber fleet, which is stationed in Thailand, began to bomb not only the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which they had bombed often before, but the Plain of Jars, which is the plain which is between the divided halves of the country, the northeast, where the Pathet Lao are in control, and the west and southwest, where the Royal Laotian government is in control. There has, in fact, been an escalation of military activity, of aerial activity, certainly by the United States, and it has not been insignificant. If the reports are, in fact, accurate, to give you some idea of the extent of this aerial activity, we read constantly of the Israeli aerial attacks against the terrorist camps, against camps in Jordan, against the Suez battle line, and against places in Syria and in Egypt. Well, there were 50 sorties by American bombers and fighter bombers in Laos for any single sortie by the Israeli against their enemy. The ratio is 50 to 1. But the one war is headlined and well publicized, and the other war is hidden and forgotten. And Americans are encouraged to believe that it is an insignificant undertaking. And there is further evidence coming out of Laos that the present attack by some Vietnamese forces further to the west, further towards the Mekong River Valley, further into the territory of the Royal Laotian government than they have ever been before, is not simply an initiative on the part of the North Vietnamese, but rather a riposte, a response to the attack by General Vang Pao, who is our own mercenary general and his Mao tribesmen, who last fall went further into the territory of the Pathet Lao than they had ever been before and took several of their major airfields and of their major communities. In other words, it is not at all clear who acted first, who is responding to whom. I have no doubt that, as the President said in his statement from Key Biscayne, that there has been constant provocation and violation of the Geneva Accords by the Pathet Lao and by the North Vietnamese. But I will remind you of the terms of the Geneva Accord, to which the Vietnamese were a signatory, but which the United States refused, by the way, to sign. And they are these: not to commit any act that might impair the sovereignty, independence, neutrality, unity, or territorial integrity of Laos; not to resort to the use or threat of force or any other measure that might impair the peace of Laos; not to interfere in any way in the internal affairs of Laos; not to introduce into Laos foreign troops or military personnel in any form whatsoever; not to establish in Laos any foreign military base, foreign strong point, or other foreign military installation of any kind; not to use the territory of Laos for interference in the internal affairs of other countries. Now, it's historically true when the Geneva Accords were signed 8 years ago, the North Vietnamese were expected to withdraw all of their forces from Laos and did not, that they left some 6,000 men in that country. And it is historically true that we then took some kind of counteraction in order to shore up our side in the country. This kind of action and reaction has taken place then year in and year on ever since. What would have happened if we had not made the original response? What would have happened if the next year and the next we had limited our response or withdrawn from Laos? Is any of us certain that the present divided kingdom would not have survived in division? Laos has been divided for the better part of the last 700 years between an eastern area largely controlled by tribes, people who are friendly with the North Vietnamese or by the North Vietnamese, and by the western part, the Mekong River Valley, which has largely been influenced and controlled by peoples who are racially, ethnically, and politically related to the Thais. Who of us is to say that this kind of division might not have remained in force had we not entered, had we not sent in our military instructors, had we not shorn up a government which perhaps needed no such shoring? There we are, with our friends and our enemies, caught in the complexities of a Southeast Asian feudal nation, uncertain of which way to go, unable to achieve limited objectives by limited commitments. What's to be the future? Escalation? The way of Vietnam? We do not know. And that is the danger, and that is the tragedy, and that is why Laos is of concern today to all Americans. In a statement from Key Biscayne, the President said two things. We are involved in Laos in order to reduce the loss of life of American personnel in Vietnam, and we are in Laos supporting the independence and neutrality of Laos, as set forth in the 1962 Geneva Agreements. Our assistance has always been at the request of the legitimate government of Prime Minister Souvanaphouma, which the North Vietnamese helped establish. We will continue to support the legitimate government of Prime Minister Souvanaphouma in his efforts to de-escalate the conflict and reach political understandings. Our air interdiction efforts are designed to protect American allied lives in Vietnam. Our supporting efforts have the one purpose of helping prevent the recognized Laotian government from being overwhelmed by larger communist forces dominated by the North Vietnamese. Two purposes, intermixed as one: to protect a particular government, which is a feudal sheikdom, and to save American lives in South Vietnam. Whether the first can be achieved, whether in fact Suvarnabhumi or any other man is the proper and popular leader of Laos, is something that Americans, State Department or otherwise, cannot tell. But what I would submit is that there is another way to save lives in South Vietnam, and that is to withdraw from South Vietnam. What we are seeing in Laos, what we certainly will see very shortly again in Thailand, where there are the same pressures of tribespeople and a feudal overlord, an oligarchy ruling out of Bangkok, of Malaysians and Mayos who are in constant rebellion against the central government, of a small aristocracy which rules a nation which is largely impoverished and illiterate. The same pressures which will inevitably break out in Thailand, which have broken out in Laos and divided that country, they will pull us down again into a morass unless we move ahead determinately and deliberately with a policy of withdrawal. Now, November 4th last, a very significant speech, the President of the United States, as you recall, proposed withdrawal. But he spoke there of peace with pride, and he insisted on a policy which had two parts to it: a phased withdrawal of American troops predicated on the success of the South Vietnamese in taking over and managing the military operation, the military security of their own nation, what's called Vietnamization. Now, many of us, as we listened to this speech, applauded the policy of withdrawal, with long overdue. But many of us wondered about Vietnamization. There have been any number of rural pacification schemes in the last 7 years in South Vietnam, and none of them has worked. There's every reason to believe that Vietnamization in its present form cannot and will not work. And as we listened to the speech on November 4th, we appreciated the integrity of the president, an integrity which he made clear by ordering the withdrawal now of some 70,000 troops of the almost 500,000 that we had in that country. But we wondered what will happen when we get to the point where American troops have been withdrawn to the point where they no longer are predominant militarily, at least in the major urban centers and on the highways, and when the South Vietnamese receive either from the Viet Cong or from the Vietnam, or because of their own weakness, some crushing defeat, which not only imperils Saigon, but imperils the security of the 250,000 logistic troops, or whatever the number may be, which we leave there. I keep coming back to the paragraphs with which the president put in his caveats. This is his speech of November 4th. At the time of the bombing halt just a year ago, there was some confusion as to whether there was an understanding on the part of the enemy that if we stopped the bombing of North Vietnam, they would stop the shelling of the cities in the south. I want to be sure that there is no misunderstanding of the part of the enemy on the part of the enemy with regard to our withdrawal program. We have noted the reduced level of infiltration, the reduction of our casualties, and are basing our withdrawal decisions partly on these factors. If the level of infiltration or our casualties increase while we are trying to scale down the fighting, it will be the result of a conscious decision by the enemy. Hanoi could make no greater mistake than to assume that increase in violence will be to its advantage. If I conclude that increased enemy action jeopardizes our remaining forces in Vietnam, I shall not hesitate to take strong and effective measures to deal with that situation. This is not a threat. This is a statement of policy, which as Commander-in-Chief of our armed forces, I am making and meeting my responsibility for the protection of American fighting men wherever they may be. Which is to say that the crucial decision has yet not been faced by our administration or by the American people. We have withdrawn 70,000 men. There are still some 400,000 men, American soldiers in Vietnam. Our striking power there is still hard and heavy. What will happen? What will happen if, in fact, there is a major attack by the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese? What will happen if there is a revolution against the unpopular Thai government by the Viet Cong or by others within South Vietnam? What will happen in effect when our solution for Vietnam, a solidification of the division between the two countries, the maintenance of the present junta in Saigon in some kind of authority, what happens if that program is threatened? If we plunge back in, and we will be tempted to do so, we have commitments. It's been clearly stated. I could write the president's speech justifying those commitments. We will be committing ourselves not only to a long, long, overly long war, which will be as feckless as the present one, but we will be committing ourselves in Laos, in Thailand, perhaps in Cambodia, to a war which will spread over all of Southeast Asia and involve perhaps not a quarter of a million or a half a million men, but 3, 4, and 5 times that number. Laos will cease to be a problem in the lives of men in South Vietnam. The lives of American men in South Vietnam are no longer endangered. Laos and Thailand will continue to remain problems, and we will continue to be committed to aristocratic, feudal, oligarchical, dictatorial governments, as long as we are there. Laos and Thailand will continue to be problems as long as our men are in Vietnam and are exposed to death and to defeat. And that's why I, for one, believe that our American will must be clear and that there must be no withdrawing from the decision to withdraw. That we must not be tempted, as I am sure we will if the moment comes, to go back in and to clean things up and to get the job done. The job cannot be done. I, for one, believe that our involvement in South Vietnam was in the first instance misbegotten and has been mischievous and worse, murderous ever since. That it is a mistake that we ought to have rectified long since, but that we must rectify now. Before the cost of Vietnam, in terms of men, in terms of treasure, in terms of the divisions within our own nation here at home, becomes more than this nation can survive. And that means that we must be clear on this, that as we withdraw, as American power ebbs in Southeast Asia, we will continue that withdrawal. Whatever the provocation, whatever the seeming danger, we have no other choice. It's not the best of all decisions and the best of all choices, but there is none other, I'm afraid, that now can be taken. And all the while, we must be very careful, you and I, that in these clandestine wars which exist in Thailand and in Laos and perhaps in Cambodia as well, we are not committed to governments, to causes quite apart from our own, and we do not find ourselves caught on the horns of commitments made secretly, commitments which may require American lives in order to be met. We have lost the war in Southeast Asia. There's no other way of looking at it. And we must pull our troops back, bring them home, and now set our own house in order and solve our own problems here before we begin any further military adventuring so far from our shores. And you know, it's not really necessary, and that's the ultimate paradox of it all. I suspect that when the history is written of our involvement in Southeast Asia, it will be said that we went into Southeast Asia in a limited way in the first instance in order to protect American economic and commercial interests in that part of the world. What we ought to have learnt from our ability now to trade with the satellites in Eastern Europe, from our ability to trade with the Soviet Union, we are talking now of trading with Communist China, is that trade can exist between countries regardless of their political ideologies. The dollar, the ruble, do not understand ideological terms. That we could have traded with Southeast Asia if we had something to trade and they had something to trade with us. And we didn't have to trade lives for the old-fashioned kind of economic privilege which allowed the governments of Europe 100 years ago to set up trading enclaves all along the Chinese Asian coast from as monopolies to their precious private benefit. That age is over and done. We live in a different world. It's a world which requires peace, not war. A world which requires the development of the underdeveloped nations and not our bombing them back the most primitive kind of state. What does the future hold for us in Southeast Asia? A great test of our national will. Have we the courage to accept defeat? America has yet to be tested. Amen.